and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud's going to take us all over America this week. We're going to be in Florida. We're going to be in St. Louis. We're going to be all over where the NWA is. And without any further ado, the man who will be leading us on this journey, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Ron, there's a lot to talk about. Last week, we talked about St. Louis and Florida. We're going to talk more about them this week. But before we even get to them, we do have to mention the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 11, with Cowboy Bill Watts.
Yes, sir. It's a tremendous program. I think fans are going to really love it. Obviously, patrons, thank all the fans, those that listen to Studcast and the ones that listen to Super Studcast. This one I think you're going to really enjoy. If you're really a historian and you want to know what it's like to not just handle finishes and just be a booker or just be a wrestler or just be an owner, but to do it all, this 2 hours plus, actually it's more than 2 hours, because Bill likes to ramble and he likes to talk, and and by golly, we really get into a lot of different aspects of the sport. It's really a great program, and I encourage people, if you're not listening to one, and even if you have, this one is a really good one. It's for wrestling historians. It is a great program.
We've talked so much about the Georgia Wrestling War, 1972, 1973, 1974. Well, we get a chance to talk a little bit to Bill Watts about that. So check that out. We'll have more information later in the show. But of course, you can go to patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com to get the Super Studcast and the rest of the story. But Ron, last week we were in Florida. We're mostly in Florida. That is your home territory right now here in 1973. But you made your first appearance in St. Louis, your first of many. You had your first one-on-one meeting with Sam Muchnick, your first of many. So there's a lot going on. I am curious, though, before we get back to the story, this is a year where you would make a lot of trips to different places. What was it like coming home? When you do something big in your career, like go to St. Louis, when you debut at the Kiel Auditorium, when you're in front of new fans and you're getting over, what's it like to go back to the territory that is your home? Is it a letdown?
No, not really. Oddly enough, guys know where you are, and I didn't really expect that, but I start missing all these Fridays, and I'm gone on Saturdays and Sundays because I'm waiting in St. Louis to do TVs, and when I get back, guys miss you, and then the questions start coming, where were you, and then once I start telling guys that I'm in St. Louis, then, they really get it's really kind of a shot in your arm, and people really get respecting you more, I think, right away when you mention that city. When you're working in that city, you're really working in one of the premier wrestling cities of all time. So, yeah, I don't take it as a step backwards, that's for darn sure. I really appreciate my home state there, Florida, and business is always good there, and it is home. It's tough being on the road. I'm in the position now where I'm gone 2-3 days a week, and I'm finding out how difficult that part of it is. But I'm glad to get back home. I don't really realize, I don't believe at this time, how much I'm accomplishing at this age. And I don't really sit down and try to assess where I am in my career. But gosh, I'm really moving upward. That's for sure.
You are. You're moving upward not only in the home of the NWA St. Louis, but in Florida. So let's return to Florida as we return to the story this week, Ron.
Okay. We'll begin here in the summer of 1973. It's an exciting summer for me. I'm still defending the Southern Heavyweight Championship just about every night when I'm in Florida. I'm not in Florida all the time anymore. I'm in St. Louis quite a bit. So I've held the title for almost 2 months now. My toughest competitor for the title has just arrived full time in Florida. He's a veteran battler that's held championships all over the world. They call him the Hammer, and it's for a darn good reason. He pounds his opponents into submission, literally. And it could only be the great Johnny Valentine I could be talking about. And obviously, I'm going to start wrestling against Johnny Valentine pretty regularly in the remainder of 1973.
We talked a little bit about that last time. I think I asked you a question about it. So let's return to this. I asked you, I think, what was it like as a young wrestler to work with Johnny Valentine? So expand upon that, but also to the listeners who never got to see Johnny Valentine, because although there is footage, there's only a little bit of footage. Explain why he was so different with pacing, with facials, with what he did in the ring. What made Johnny Valentine so special?
He was totally unique. I mean, he had a different style than any other wrestler I ever wrestled against. He liked the long matches. He believed in wrestling. He liked to take a hold, and he liked to keep that hold. Sometimes he would take a front face lock in a 50-minute match, and I would not get out of that front face lock for 25 minutes. And when I did get out, it meant something. You know, that's what was so remarkable about working with him. You didn't do a whole lot, but everything you did meant something to the crowd. And every time you finally got out of a hold, or you finally got him rocking a little bit, you hit him with a few punches, and all of a sudden, instead of coming forward, he's going back. The crowd would come up to their feet. It was just an exciting thing to wrestle him, because you knew the last 15, 20, 30 minutes of the match, you're going to have that crowd. And you would go and watch other matches that night. Nobody got him where he's going to get him during the course of the night. And to be in the ring and be able to do it with him was just, it was exciting for me. Not so exciting for a lot of guys. He pounded the people to death. And he, a guy like Tim Woods, never got a suntan. You could see 2 days after a match with Valentine, you could see his handprints all over him where he smacked him in the chest and the stomach and the back, several different places on his body. He was difficult to be able to stay in there with him and to not get this totally. He was the type of talent that he could totally bury you in a match. And you had to fight. If you fought back with him and you realized that he was going to give you something eventually, and when you knew that when he gave it to you, it's going to pop that crowd, it's going to have everybody on their feet. That's what I learned pretty quickly, is that, you know, don't be concerned because you're not going anywhere, and you've been face first in the mat for 25 minutes and trying to get out for that length of time. Because when you do get out, it's going to be meaningful.
Before he gets there, before you start working with him, do any of the boys say anything to you? I mean, he's a notorious ribber. He's a notoriously stiff wrestler. Does anyone warn you about him before he gets there? What are you hearing? And also, does he fit in with the locker room there? Because obviously he's a bit older. I mean, I think he started wrestling even before Eddie did. Did he fit in Florida?
Yeah, he fits in. Yes, he does. And he has a lot of respect in the dressing room. You can see it when he comes in. It's just different in the dressing room. Guys are like, they move over and they back up and they, you know, and they nod their head and they speak to him. He just has a way. He has some charisma about him that's just, it's unbelievable. And it's not just in the ring, but it's in the dressing room and pretty much everywhere he goes. I don't tell you a real quick story here. And Johnny Valentine and Buddy Colt are going out in Jacksonville one night, and they go over to Jacksonville Beach. You spend the night on Thursday nights, and a lot of times you're wrestling in Tallahassee on Friday. So rather than go back to Tampa, you stay over in Tallahassee, and you drive across to Tallahassee, and then you drive home from Tallahassee. And they're in it's a little diner in Jacksonville Beach, and it's probably 2 o'clock in the morning. There's a few drunks in there. It's an old place where, you know, on the bar and on the tables, they got the old ketchup bottles and the mustard bottle and the whole deal. And so they're sitting at the bar, and there's a table behind them. It's got four guys at it, and they both got the dyed blonde hair, and they, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and a couple of these guys have had something to drink. And finally, one of them gets up and he comes over and he comes to Colt, and he says, you guys are those wrestlers, aren't you? A couple of wrestlers. And Colt says, yeah, we are. Go away. You know, they're talking, Johnny and Colt. And Colt says, go away, man. Don't bother us. And the guy goes, no. He goes, I want to talk to you guys. He goes, I went watching that wrestling, and it's all a bunch of fake stuff, and it's all a bunch of fake crap. And Colt says, go away, kind of shoos him away. Go away, sit down, man, before you get hurt. No. That blood, when y'all bleed, he goes, that's just ketchup, isn't it? It's just ketchup. And Colt says, man, you go away. Just leave us alone, you know. And he just continues, no. I want you to explain to me, is that real blood or ketchup? And Colt just reaches up. The bottle of ketchup is sitting on the bar right in front of him. And he reaches up, grabs the top of the bottle, and he just smacks this guy right across the forehead with the ketchup bottle. Right. And it busts the ketchup bottle, and it busts his head as well. And he goes back unconscious. Blake takes a bump on his back, and all of his buddies are going, Oh my God. You know, look, he's bleeding. He's bleeding. And they're going to jump up to help him up. And Colt says, no, sit down. Don't touch him. So they go, well, wait, he's bleeding. And he goes, no, it ain't blood. It's just ketchup. And so Johnny and Buddy sit there, and they don't let these guys get him up. The guy that runs the place leaves him laying in the floor bleeding, and they eat the rest of their meal. And then when they leave, they said, okay, you can get him now. You can get him up now. You know, they were rugged guys back in those days. And Johnny Valentine was, and they were lucky it wasn't Johnny. And I heard a story about
Johnny. I was going to say, this is one of those rare stories where he's the innocent party involved.
Yeah, he happens to be sitting on the wrong seat to be getting involved, right? So, but I have another real quick one about Johnny one time. A guy's giving him some crap, and it's after a match, and it's outside on the sidewalk in the front of the building. And I guess he's coming out late. It's after the match is over, and this guy hangs around just to get in his face. And he starts on Johnny, and Johnny gives him kind of like the Colt deal. You know, get away. Go on home, man. You're going to get hurt. Just get out of here. And the guy just won't take no for an answer. And somehow, you know, the guy finally ends up taking a swing at Johnny. And Johnny ducks it, and Johnny nails him. And he hits him with a big right hand. And the guy goes down. He busts his forehead, and when he hits on the back of the concrete, it busts the back of his head, too. And about that time that he takes the bump, a cop comes walking around the far side of the building. And Johnny's like, oh, jeez, what am I going to do now, right? So he drops down, and he gets the guy, and he puts the guy's head in his lap. And he's saying, oh, come on now, Joe, you got to get up, man. We got to get out of here. You know, you've just drank too much. And the cop kind of comes by. He don't really notice the blood. Valentine says, oh, he's okay. He's okay. He's a buddy of mine. And the cop says, okay, we'll take care of him. And the cop walks over there. Valentine drops the guy's head on the concrete and gets up and goes home. So, you know, Those guys were tough son of a guns, man. And they didn't make it easy on anybody. And anybody wanting to mess with them was just stupid, plain stupid.
So how many times did you get to work with Johnny during this period of time?
I worked with him quite a few times. I worked with him. I defended against him twice in the early part of June. And then he's going to win the championship from me later on. But during the same time frame, I defend twice against him in June. I was looking up the records here, three times against Dick Slater in that month, in the early part of the month, four times against Gorgeous George Jr., once against Chris Markoff, once against Dale Lewis, and once against Buddy Coate. I mean, that just tells you what the talent level is in Florida at that point in time, you know, probably as good as anywhere on earth. You know, these great, great heels are all there. And while these defenses are going on, there's another thing that's happening there. We talked about Louis Tillette's come in and he's doing some of the booking now. And as these all these title defenses are going on, Paul Jones, a former champion, and he's set. Louis puts together an angle which is most unusual. He pits two heels having problems against each other. And that's Buddy Colt and Paul Jones. And in fact, he involves Buddy Colt in the match in which I beat Paul Jones for the Southern Heavyweight title just to keep that angle going. And that match cost Paul Jones the title. So it's only natural that he'd be mad at Colt, just as mad as he was at me. And, you know, it's very unusual in the sport to take two heels and focus them on each other. But I thought it was a great angle because you can see what develops out of it as this angle goes on. By doing this, it's pretty ingenious. I can defend against both of them. I got a title here now. I can defend against both those guys. And then they've got their own personal feud, so they can put them against each other on some nights, which is real unusual. See two heels in the ring at the same time against each other. Sometimes there's two baby faces, but very seldom two heels. So it's a really pretty nice little concept he's got. Now, and then he's turning. What he's doing is he's taking the slow turn of Paul Jones from heel to babyface. And on May 23rd, 1973 in Miami, he puts me as a partner with Paul Jones against Buddy Colt and Chris Markoff. Now, here to me is a great example of a fantastic finish in this particular match. You've got most unusual. You got three heels and one baby face in the same tag match. I'm already, when I go to the ring, I get the big can. Everybody else gets booed, including Paul, who's basically my partner. So during the course of the match, Paul turns on me and when he turns on me, he gets me bleeding and then he leaves me in the ring by myself against Colt and Markoff. He just, once I'm bleeding and down and out, he just leaves the ring, goes to the dressing room. And so they continue to pound on me. And then they don't want to beat me. They pull me up three or four times. I'm beat. You know, they could have beat me 10 times and they don't do it. They just keep pulling me up and pulling me up. Now, Rob is back there. He's worked earlier in the night. He's already had a shower. He's got his street clothes on. But I'm trying to get to the corner. I don't even realize that there's nobody there to tag. So, you know, the crowd is really, this is getting some really good heat because, you know, now I'm in a horrible, desperate situation. So Rob comes down, jumps up on the apron, and he becomes my partner. He's got his arm out there. He's trying to tag me. So I fight like crazy, and I get to him. He comes in, and he starts to come back, and after a minute or so, I get myself together, and I start in the comeback with him. And now we take over. We're beating the hell out of Colt and Markoff. And then he sends, first time there's ever been any altercation between us or any contact between us and the Samoan team, Louis sends the Samoans, and the Samoans come in, and now there's four against the two of us, and they pound us down. They get Rob bleeding. He's bleeding all over his clothes. I mean, it's a nasty match. It's one of those matches where you're looking for a riot. You know, this is a very, very hot deal. And eventually they leave us laying there, and they record the match, and they use it on the TV show, which is the following Wednesday. You wrestled in Miami on Wednesday night. You wrestled the following Wednesday on TV in the mornings, and then you would go to Miami. So they're going to use this match the following Wednesday, and they're going to have me and Rob do the commentary over it, because they're setting up now an angle with us and the Samoans for the Florida tag titles. Heck of a way to go into it. And what they were doing back in those days, they were using 16-millimeter film. They didn't have any video. No, weren't capable of doing videos except with cameras that were in studios and things like that. So Florida was unique by using this 16-millimeter videos in these house shows. Then they would show them back on TV. It is a very effective way of creating and pushing angles. The Florida Territory is the first one in the world that's going to use this technique of filming matches live from an arena and then including them in your television broadcast. So when I begin Southeastern Championship Wrestling in the next year, I'm going to utilize this format. I see the strength in it, and there's so many good things about it. Television studios, they're just small, and they don't convey the excitement and the spectacle of a huge crowd at a live arena. There's nothing you can do in a studio that holds 150 people that can even come close to what the response and the excitement that is developed in a 5,000 to 10,000 seat arena, in which you've got all those bodies in there. So it's by recording these shows, they take it. It just really takes your television show to a whole new level. When you see those fans, instead of just seeing that small studio crowd, and you pop away to one of those big cities like Miami, and there's 10,000 people in that crowd, the people at home, they're like, wow, they're amazed and astounded by it. So, you know, it's a great way of doing television. And Eddie was far and far ahead of everybody else at TV in those days. And Gordon Solie was being involved, and Gordon was highly involved. And he wanted to do commentary over these shows. After he took these live segments, he would come back and do commentary over top of them and cut them here and there, take away the basic spots where you were selling, and just have the highlights of the match, basically. So it was a tremendous, what was happening in Florida was great. It was very few places anywhere in the world that they were handling business the way we were in Florida at that time frame.
You started talking about the filming of wrestling, but we were talking about you and Robert and the angle with the Samoans. What happened with all that?
Well, we're actually going to end up wrestling them for the championship. 3 weeks after they work this angle, we're going to wrestle them again in Miami for the first time. And we're going to win the titles from them in the very first match. And when we do win that championship, now I'm still the Southern Heavyweight Champion. So I'm sitting now as the Southern Heavyweight Champion and one half of the Florida Tag Champions at the same time. I don't know if that's ever been done before or after in Florida or not. Got no way to check those type of records, but I'm just now celebrating the end of my third year in the ring. So I haven't been in the ring very long. I'm getting a lot of things done and beginning to make a real name for myself. On June 26th, same year, I lose the Southern Championship to Johnny Valentine in Tampa. I will have been champion for 76 days. I will have defended it 45 times in 76 days. That's got to be close to an all-time record for the defense of that particular title. I was really, really hell-bent on defending it as much as I could. Then the rest of the summer in 1973, Rob and I, we hold the tag championship. We defend against the former champions 10 times. And I also get 4 shots at my old title, the old Southern title with Johnny Valentine. I can't get him anytime in that summer. And all that is going on. And besides that, then we're also I'm also highly involved in St. Louis and making those trips just about every other weekend.
Hey, Ron, I'm curious. Obviously, Tampa was the number one city for championship wrestling from Florida, and that's where you lost the Southern title. You won the tag titles in Miami. After Tampa, how do you rank the cities in terms of importance for the territory?
Well, Tampa was the home of Florida championship wrestling, obviously, and normally that's going to be your key city. All your boys are going to live there. And they did great business in Tampa. They happened to have a National Guard army that was huge. And they let the wrestling promoters, Eddie and them, come in and build out the building for wrestling. So, you know, they really put the bleachers all around, and they built the double-deck bleachers. And they really packed that army with as many people as they possibly could. So Tampa was kind of your hoss, but that was a very unusual territory. You also had Miami. Now, Miami's an even bigger city, and there are a lot of times, in fact, most of the time, Miami's going to outdraw Tampa because Tampa's army is only going to hold about 5,000 people. Miami's Civic Center Convention Hall is going to hold 10,000 plus. You look at the Monday nights. You got two Monday night towns. You got West Palm that's got about a 9,000 seat building, and they're selling that sucker out on Mondays. And the same night, you've got the Orlando Sports Stadium, and it holds about 6,000, and it's selling out. So Mondays is your biggest night, but Tampa's your biggest town. Now you throw into that mix Jacksonville, and they've got a beautiful round coliseum there. It's a fantastic building, probably 12,000 seats. And occasionally you get the sellouts in Jacksonville, and that'll be your biggest night of the week. So, you know, it's hard to say which town is the best for them. It depends on which one could draw the most money for them. And you could probably draw the biggest crowds in Jacksonville of a whole state. But they never had the impact or the crowds that you got in Miami, West Palm, Tampa, Orlando. So, you know, that's a good question, though. And then, you know, you went on your Friday night. You had Tallahassee in the north part of the state and Fort Lauderdale going in the south part of the state. And you're pretty darn busy there. Saturday nights, once a month or so, you'd end up in St. Pete Coliseum, which is another beautiful round building, probably 8,000. I'm going to guess around 8,000 people. It would always be sold out. So it was an interesting territory to work. It had a lot of potential for big houses and a lot of excitement in that territory back in those days.
We will return after the break, not to Florida, but to St. Louis. But first, a word about Super Studcast number 11 with Cowboy Bill Watts.
Super Studcasts seem to get better with each new one. The Stud gives us funny stories, crazy wrestlers, friendships, family, and wonderful wrestling history. Super Studcast number 11 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast introduces an individual that's similar to the Stud, has done it all in his career. Wrestler, booker, and builder of territories. The big cowboy from Oklahoma defines the word legend. Success has followed Bill Watts everywhere he went, and so has the 45-year relationship between these two icons. Humble beginnings led him to Ohio, the Atlanta Wrestling War in Georgia, Florida, Mid-South Wrestling, WCW, and WWE. Super Studcast number 11 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast touches on all these places, companies, people, and events that make wrestling the fascinating sport it is. So saddle up and ride into wrestling history where few have ever been.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 11 with Cowboy Bill Watts, a supersized Super Studcast, I guess I can call it. The Cowboy, as we're all aware, has a lot to say. And we said, say whatever you want. So usually the Super Studcast is 2 hours. This time, Cowboy Bill Watts had a lot to get off his chest. 2.5 hours with Cowboy Bill Watts, Super Studcast number 11. Check that out at patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com only. $2.99. Check it out right now. More information later on in the show. But Ron, we've teased it. We've talked about Florida. Now you're returning to St. Louis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really cranking here, and I'm spending part of my weeks in Florida now, usually from Mondays to Thursdays. On Friday, I'm on the plane. I'm spending 3 days a week in St. Louis on the weekends. I work Friday night in Kiel. I sit sometimes doing nothing but going to the gym, that type of stuff on a Saturday. And on Sunday, they work three TVs, three shows at a time. So you're going to get a lot of work there on Sundays too. And then I go back to the Florida routine. So when I'm going to St. Louis during the summertime of 1973, I'm going to work there 10 times. Now, Sam Muchick does something that's most unusual for any promotion. Because he was a sports writer for the St. Louis paper, he used to cover the St. Louis Cardinals and wrestling. That's how he got interested in wrestling and how he becomes involved. But he's also a huge baseball fan. So he doesn't want his wrestling to even compete with the St. Louis Cardinals. So he runs shows up until May, and he shuts down St. Louis entirely up until August, late August. Practically the whole summer is no wrestling in St. Louis. That's unbelievable. No place in the world is like that, because summertime is your best time of year normally, and to close your territory down or your town down in the middle of summer, it's just remarkable that he chose to do that. Those TVs, you still went in. I still go in and work the TVs, because you only had three TVs at a time and you're not going to be in there for 2 months. So I go back. I work at the end of that season there, which is in June. I'm going to work my final match that year for that season. That's what he called it. That's what Sam called it. It was this season. I worked the last match with Terry Funk, 30-minute Broadway. Great match in Kiel. And then I'm going to open up the next season on August the 24th against the former world heavyweight champion, Gene Koninsky, who is now the Missouri title owner. And I'm going to get a title shot with Gene Koninsky on August the 24th, 1973 in St. Louis, in Kiel again. I worked television a lot that entire summer, a total of 8 matches in all. I get a win on TV over Bill and Danny Miller with a partner named Jim Johnson. Now, Bill and Danny Miller are, gosh, one of the biggest and one of the best teams in the world. Both these guys are huge. And it's great for me to see Danny Miller. He's a friend of mine. We worked a whole lot of tags in my first year in Florida in 1970 and 71. Danny Miller is there. So it's like a old homecoming for me and Danny to be able to sit down with Danny and talk about things. And Danny's so proud of me. He says, you know, he talks and, gosh, Ron, look at where you are, man. You made it to St. Louis already, and which is really nice comments, and I really appreciate it. I get a win over Jim Lancaster. I get a win in a handicap match against two opponents, one of those television programs, Percy Pringle and Jay French. Now, Percy Pringle is going to become Paul Bearer and manage The Undertaker for WWE. So it's the same guy. And Paul Bearer starts out as a wrestler and ends up as a manager. But then I'm going to get a win over Jim Dalton, the Dalton brothers, a pretty darn good tag team combination, a good win there for me there. And then the last win I get on TV during that summer is one over Tim Conway, who's a very talented wrestler with a really big future. Finally, the last Sunday in the summer, I'm going to work 3 times on TV in the same day. Like I said, they do 3 TVs, but hardly ever did anybody get all 3 TVs. I'm going to go in. It's going to be the hardest and most punishing day I ever spent wrestling on television, working on television anywhere. It's 3 matches. And when I get there, they say, Ron, you've got 3 matches today. And I'm like, wow, you know, I'm thinking, geez, man, television lights, summertime, it's hot. This is going to be really, really a struggle. And so I ask them, who's the 3? And they give me the lineup. I got Johnny Valentine first. I've got Gene Koninsky second. And I've got Terry Funk third. So it's like, I'm looking at that list and going, oh, man, what an afternoon this is going to be. So, you know, and they give me about 40 minutes basically between matches. So the first one is with Johnny Valentine, And we go about 20 minutes, and I actually get a win over Johnny on TV in St. Louis, which is, gosh, a remarkable thing. Second match, about 40 minutes after this match with Johnny Valentine, I'm back in there with Gene Kaniski. And we go 20 minutes, about 20 minutes again, and end up fighting out on the floor, and both of us get counted out. And so then I get about another 40-minute rest, and I'm pretty blown up by this point. And they've got me with Terry Funk in the last one. And it's a 20-minute Broadway. And then they tell me, they say, Ron, at the end of this last match with Funk, after it's over, before you leave the ring, we want you to do an interview. The interview is about wrestling Kaniski at the opening of the season. So we're right there at that time frame. And so I'm like, wow, to do it. Now, I've had these two struggles, long matches against difficult opponents, and then to have a 20-minute with Terry and then be able not to go take yourself a wind, catch your breath or anything, to stand there in the ring. They come right into the ring immediately following that match, and they start talking to me. Now, this television station that we're in at this point, it has a stairway that goes upstairs. You wind around. It's a little winding type of staircase. And I'm standing in the ring after the match, and I am really blown up. I just, man, Terry's hard to deal with anyway. Terry likes to move, and he'd only wrestle once that day, and this is my third time. And he really takes me to the limit. And then the gentleman comes in. I think it's Larry Matusik, right? I believe that's
Larry
his name.
Matusik.
So Larry comes in and he starts to do the interview. And I start into the interview. The interview is 2 minutes long. I get about a minute into the interview and I can feel that I'm about to vomit. I mean, I'm not going to make it. I'm just like struggling now. Oh, I'm just trying to fight it. Out of breath, I can feel it trying to come up. I'm like, oh, come on. I'd make it to the end of the 2 minutes, and I don't even say anything to him when it's over. I just bolt right through the ropes onto the floor, and I start up those stairs, and I can't even make it to the top. I get to where you turn around, turn the corner to go up another level, and I turn it loose. I can't help it, man. I make a big mess in the studio, obviously. What a hard, hard day for me, and I'll never forget it. I remember going in and asking them who I've got, and then when they gave me the deal, and then an interview, a live interview on the end, I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be terrible, and it was a struggle for sure.
Let's go to a situation where you're not blown up. At this point in your career, are you a good promo?
I'm getting better. You know, I mean, that's something that takes a lot of time. You probably more time to learn to talk than it does to learn to work. And I'm getting to be a pretty decent promo. But, you know, I'm not going to hit that stride until I get to Knoxville in 74, 75. And then I kind of get my whole act together. But, yeah, it's difficult as a young guy. I was in a great position because I was in Florida and there were great talkers there. You know, Valentine was a great talker. Dusty Rhodes was there. Dusty was always fantastic. There was a lot of guys always in that Florida territory that were good talkers. And when you work TV all day long and you're there for television, you go in to make interviews. Once you start getting booked in top matches, you have to make interviews for all those markets, every market in Florida, everywhere it goes, that tape goes. And so you start to learn quick. I got the opportunity after about a year and a half to start doing a few interviews for Fort Myers, where I was kind of on top, but that would be my only interview. Now I'm in a position where I'm interviewing a lot for a lot of different markets. So I'm improving, but no, I'm not there as a great talker yet. Probably far from it.
We're talking about the summer of 73, Ron. Around this period of time would have been the NWA convention. Had you started going to the NWA convention yet by this point?
I had been to a couple of them with Dad, but I never went into any meetings or anything like that. But I wanted to go that year because, I mean, obviously business is changing for me, and I'm not just a young punk. You know, now I'm beginning to be recognized. So I go to the meeting, and Sam sees me at the meeting, Sam Muchnick, and he's the president of the NWA. And he says, "Ron, why don't you just come into the meetings?" And I was like, wow, you know, I'm invited in. I'm not a promoter. And most of those meetings are just filled with guys that own territories and they're actual promoters. So it's a great opportunity for me, you know, and I say, heck yeah, Sam, are you sure? Yeah, yeah. You know, he's like, oh, Ron, does anybody question me? I was like, no, I don't guess they do, Sam. So, yeah, so. And they, what they did, about twice a day, you're there for 3 days. First 2 days are meetings, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, usually around 3 hours each. At night, everybody gets together and parties and builds relationships and talks business. It's a very productive thing, that National Wrestling Alliance Convention. So I get to go into meetings, which is, gosh, an honor for me, man. And they're strange, you know, I mean. They're really different because you're sitting there with people from all over the world, and you look around and you've got Japanese people on one area, and you've got people from England, and yeah, people from Germany, people from Australia, people from Mexico, from Canada. I mean, you know, basically all over the world. And it's like, you know, I have an opportunity to start putting these faces with names that I've heard as a young kid all of my life. And that's a really nice thing for me. I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's a great opportunity for me. I just relish it. I'm there at the beginning of every meeting. I've stayed to the very end. I'm trying to shake hands with people that I've never met and introduce myself. And it's a very, very uplifting situation for me. This is going to become part of my life, this National Wrestling Alliance. As soon as I get my territory, I'm going to make a bid for it, and obviously I get accepted. And so this is just a good taste for me as a first opportunity to sit in one of those meetings.
Talk a little bit more about those meetings, because it always has fascinated wrestling fans what went on in the inner sanctum of the NWA. How did the promoters behave with one another? Did everyone get along?
Everyone was very, very nice and cordial at meetings. But the one thing that really struck me in that particular meeting is the language. I mean, gosh almighty, some of these promoters are just wow. They can't string together two normal words. It's like every other word out of their mouth is a curse word, right? And I'm like, wow. And Roy Shire, out of San Francisco, in Northern California territory, he was top dog when it came to a nasty mouth. I mean, he was so bad within the first meeting that Sam had to stop him. He was on some kind of tirade about something he was upset about or something he didn't like or whatever. And he was just constantly, everything that came out of his mouth was the F-bomb and everything else. Sam says, wait, Roy, please, hold up a minute. He goes, we can't have this. You know, he goes, you've got to be able to speak in a normal language to us. And can you cut out some of those curse words? And Roy gets pissed. And he goes, hell no. I mean, he starts right. He must come out with five dirty darn words immediately, you know, about kiss my ass. It just got worse and worse and worse. And so Sam goes, well, wait a minute. Wait, he has to stop him again. Wait, Roy, please. Wait, Roy. Hold up. He goes, I think what we're going to do is, he goes, I've got a sheet of paper here. And he goes, I'm going to mark down every curse word, and anybody for the rest of this meeting who says a curse word, I'm going to fine you $10 per word. So Roy says, and I figured, well, you know, this is going to stop him. And he goes, Oh, okay. And he just starts in this horrible rant. And I look up there and Sam, he's marking the market. And after about 2 minutes straight, I don't think he had anything but curse words. I don't think he said anything but a curse word. And then Sam says, okay, that's enough. It gets him stopped. And he goes, that's $200. And so Roy goes, well, that ain't a drop in the damn bucket. He goes, and he starts again. Sam's marking him down. After another couple of minutes, whoa, Roy, please, whoa. That's another 200. Everybody got a big laugh out of that, you know, and everybody got several big laughs out of the meeting. Actually, because it's really nice. It's a social affair in a way, and you see the same guys being together at night. You'll see them having dinner together, and I get invited that time to have dinner with Jim Barnett and Sam Muchnick. So what an honor that is. I'm sitting with two of the greatest on earth and having dinner with them. It's strange being around that much talent and that many stars, because most of these promoters are old wrestling stars themselves, and to just see them and be a part of it, it was a tremendous experience for me. In fact, Sam does something else then during that meeting. He introduces me, you know, and he didn't ask me about this, but he at one point and he says, you know, I've got a young guy sitting back here that's in my main event in Kiel. I'm going to start my season on August the 24th, and this young guy is going to be wrestling Gene Koninsky. And he says, Ron, stand up, introduce yourself. So I get up, I'm young, and this is worse than doing an interview. You know, I was like, gosh, what do you say to these guys in this group? You know, so I just, you know, thank them for the opportunity to be there and to be a part of it and the whole darn deal. And then Gene's there. Gene Koninsky's there. And Gene gets up, you know, which is really funny. And everybody, Gene gets up and he cuts a promo on me, man. I mean, it's like he's a shoot promo, right? And he starts into me, young boy, look at him. He's tall and thin. And boy, he's going to be even taller and more thin because I'm going to stretch him. He gets started into it. And I'm going to do this to him and I'm going to do that to him. And everybody in the place is laughing. They're all just laughing at me. I'm still standing up. I should have sat down. But I'm still standing up. I got nothing to say when he finishes. Like, what the hell do I say to that? So, you know, and he ends up by saying something like, you know, kid, you don't know what a bad night you're going to have in about 20 days. It was about 20 days before our match. And I started thinking about that. And constantly, I think for the next 20 days, I really kind of really wasn't looking forward to this beatdown I'm likely to get with Gene Koninsky. And Gene Koninsky, and for fans that don't remember Gene or don't know much about Gene Koninsky, he's from Canada out there on the West Coast. And he's a monster guy. He's about 6'5", maybe 280, just mean and broad. I think he played football in the Canadian League. He's just a tough, tough son of a gun. And I've heard all these bad things. I watched him wrestle my father in Atlanta for the world title. And that match, I really got a respect for Koninsky. I was like, wow, this guy's tough. So this is going to be my opportunity to see what I can do against Gene Koninsky in August 24th, 1973.
Well, you did kind of tease that a little bit earlier, so why don't we go to this now? You said you would come back to this match. What happened with you and Koninsky?
Well, in the match itself, he obviously blew me up because I was young and I was very nervous. And I think that has more of an effect on you than anything else when you're a young wrestler is you can blow yourself up in the dressing room just thinking about what's about to happen in the ring. And so he blew me up. But I was able to do some things in there that really, really he was astounded with, I guess, you know. And he told me so after the match. Obviously, he wins this match. I don't go beating Jim Kaninsky for the Missouri title, one of my first matches in St. Louis. And I certainly wouldn't have expected. I would have been amazed if they'd have put me over. And obviously, I'm not at that point where I could handle that. But in this match, he does a high spot with me, and he calls a, do you know what a flying head scissor is?
Yeah.
I mean, you very seldom see anybody use it anymore. And there weren't a lot of guys that used it anyway, because you had to be fairly tall. You had to have long legs. You had to be able to drop kick to get your height, to be able to get up to a guy's head. Now, Kaninsky's 6'5", so he's not a short guy. And he calls a spot with me, a tackle, drop down, leapfrog, and flying head scissor. And I'm like, wow, thing, you know, you don't have time to think about these things, you know. He calls the spot, and he shoots you in the ropes, and, you know, you shoot him in the ropes, and it's going, you know. You don't have to say, you don't have time to figure out, now, how I'm going to do this, and how can I set up you? I mean, it's quick, 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 quick. So, and I catch him with that flying head scissor, and it was a beauty. I got way up there, and I was able to wrap my legs around his head and then be able to push my body higher into the air, which really makes a flying head scissor pretty, makes it more beautiful. And boy, it was a good one, and I gave him a good one. In fact, he called for another one just almost immediately following. Because he really heard the crowd pop, and he knew it was good, too. And then after the match was over, he was nice enough to come and talk to me, which that's always good when you've got an old veteran like that that wants to sit down and spend a little time and tell you how you can improve yourself. That's one of the great learning lessons you get as a young guy. Those old veterans that you have opportunity to work with, if they don't come to you, I used to try to go to them, and I'd ask them, what can I do to improve myself? He comes to me and he says, kid, you're really good. You know, he'd never seen me work, I don't think, you know, and he said, you know, the flying head scissor was absolutely phenomenal. And he goes, wow, you know, so that was a nice thing for me. I really enjoyed it. And it was a great compliment. And, we end up having a great match, probably went 45 minutes. And like I said, I blew up after about 15 of it, and I continued on for the next 30, just my tongue hanging out. But it was a great experience for me. I had worked with one of the stiffest and toughest guys in the business and a former world champion. And I just... It was an honor for me to be a part of that match.
Well, Ron, we're going to do something now that we haven't done in quite a while here on the show. Listener questions. Of course, we always love answering the listener questions, but we've been running so long with so much content lately, we haven't had a chance. So we're going to dive back into the mailbag here, and we have a few listener questions. And the first one here is from Gerald Lowry in Sydney, Australia. Ron, why do you think Jim Barnett sold out of the Australia territory after 10 successful years there?
That's a good question. You know, that's a great question because, you know, he's great. Barnett goes in there and he has really 10 hugely successful years there in Australia. Gosh, I mean, you know, I think, well, let's just start. My first thing that comes to my head is maybe it's a little bit of boredom. And it could be have something to do with what happened to Jim Barnett in the Midwestern part of the United States after about 10 years of running everything basically from Detroit and Chicago and Indianapolis. And, you know, gosh, he just had a massive amount of towns and huge cities that he was running. And you know, you get bored. Sometimes after a while, you just get bored with going to the same places and the same houses and that type of thing. And, you know, a great example of that is how Jim was getting bored is I had a guy tell me that they were in the amphitheater in Chicago, sold out, big, huge crowd, and Barnett has limo bring him up, and he comes to the back of the, there's a big curtain there, and he just pulls the curtain back, and the guy's standing there next to him, and he's talking to himself. He doesn't even say it to the guy. He just looks at the crowd, and he goes, "Oh, God, another sellout. Might as well go home." And he turns around and goes back and gets in the limo and leaves. He doesn't speak to anybody. You know, so there, he's had this huge success in the United States. And now he goes to Australia. He experiences it again. And I think when you stay someplace for 10 years, things get more difficult. You got to change your bookers, and you got to change your talent on time. And there's so many things you have to do to just keep that ball rolling. Well, it's pretty easy to get one rolling where your town starts selling out, but then how do you continue to get that process working? And I think he's starting to experience a little bit that in the Midwest when he leaves America. And I think he's beginning to experience a little bit of that drop off and the difficulty in drawing those big houses that he was drawing in the first 5 years in Australia as well. I really think the problem was is the tax changes in that country. I think this is more likely the reason he sold is because somehow in the country of Australia during this time frame, they passed a law that if you're not Australian, you can't own a business in Australia. So that just basically eliminates Barnett from Australia because he obviously, unless he wants to take on a partner or get somebody as a figurehead or whatever it is, this is not a good opportunity for him. This is a bad thing. And I'm sure he went crazy when he saw that this is about to happen. So that was part of it. I'm sure that was part of it. No doubt that was part of it. And then there, and one other I can think of automatically off the top of my head is this is kind of a perfect time for Atlanta. For someone to make a move to Atlanta. It's during the course of the Atlanta Wrestling War. He's got Barnett, he's got Dad there. I've been there early 1973. His relationship with my father and with Eddie Graham is becoming more and more solid all the time. And then he knows that Lester is just worn out by this Atlanta war. Lester kind of comes in at the worst possible time. All of this goes down under his ownership. He has to deal with how am I going to get the NWA involved and how am I going to fight this battle and who am I going to get to book and I've lost all my wrestlers. I mean, he had the worst scenario ever for coming in and taking over a company. And so Lester's ready to go. Now, Barnett's sitting there. Barnett's got money. He's made a tremendous amount of money. So he's got this bread, and he can look at Atlanta and say, what if I bought Lester out? And the reason he would want to do this is Ted Turner. It even goes further back, in my opinion. He's a smart guy, and he realizes that he wants the power that could come with the fact that he could be the most powerful guy in wrestling if he had Atlanta and he had Turner's worldwide television coverage. And so him being who he is and having been a powerful guy and seeing what's happening in Atlanta and thinking I could buy Lester out, he's probably thinking far enough ahead that I could buy Ann out and then I would have it. And then it's just me on Turner. And I get to 2 hours rather than the 1 hour that they have now. He puts all the pieces of this puzzle together, and he probably decides that this is now the time for me to make this move because somebody is going to do it. And that's exactly what was going to happen. Lester was not qualified and did not want to stay there anymore after he had gone through this war. And Barnett is a perfect guy to be in the position to run that figurehead of that Atlanta, which is going to become, just like I said, the most he'll become the most powerful man in wrestling as soon as he makes this deal. And within the next few years, he will be the monster in the sport.
Ron, we have one more question. This one was sent in by Ian Totten. Do you think things would have been different during the Atlanta War had Ray Gunkel not died?
Whoa, very hypothetical, but gosh, that would change things. That would make a huge difference probably in a lot of what happened in the war. So I'd have to say right off the top of my head, the answer would be yes, it would be different. Now, in the end of all this, I don't think the outcome would have been any different. But I believe if Ray had, you know, if he was in a position before his death to become a star again in the territory that he had been a star, an established star in for 20 years. So if he had not died, he's not only going to be one of his wrestlers, he's going to be one of his stars in that company, in his new company. That I see when he died, that opportunity died with him because he was a good worker and he was admired by the fans and respected by the fans and loved by the fans, never been anything but a baby face in that territory. So he would have really made it a different situation had he been able to work on those cards himself. Another thing, he was much more knowledgeable about the wrestling business than his wife, Ann, who's going to take up those reins of his plans to try to create his own company. Had he been there, he would have made a lot of decisions that she probably made incorrectly. He would have done a better job with. And then he had a lot of influence and a lot of respect. He'd been around wrestling for a long time and everybody knew him, and he went to the NWA meetings and he was respected and admired. And if this he had lived and the NWA would have been in a position then to having said, because Ray was gone and Ann was establishing a new company and never had she been a part of the NWA, it made the decision for the NWA easier to go with Lester because he has the established company that had been there. If Ray had been alive, I think there would have been meetings within the NWA in which they would have sat down and say, well, we've got two wrestlers here that want to have the same town, used to be partners, and who are we going to go with? Are we going to go with Lester Welch, or are we going to go with our old buddy, Ray Gunkel, that's been there for a long, long time? That would have been a very, very crucial decision for the NWA. Had they decided, obviously, to go with Gunkel, whoever the NWA went with was going to win this war. That's a basic end of it. And that's the biggest point that could be made here is the NWA territory there was going to win the war. And that's exactly what happened in the end. I believe, like this gentleman has suggested here, though, that it would have made a difference and things would have, I think they would have lasted longer than what they lasted. But I don't believe in the end, without the support of the NWA, that there would have been any way Ray could have won it had he lived.
Ron, two questions, only one winner. Who do you pick?
Boy, both of them are really great questions. I'm going to take the gentleman from Australia. I think it's a great concept of you know, why Jim ends up in Atlanta and why he would leave a country and a business like he developed there for 10 years in Australia. And I think I'll go with that one. I think that'll be our winner. And I can't remember, Gerald Lowry, I think that's what it was, right?
Yeah.
From Sydney. Yes. Congratulations, Gerald.
That was a rather truncated version of your accent.
Well, probably not too good. I hope you forgive me, Gerald.
I'm sure he will. Well, once again, Gerald, you are the winner. Someone from the show will be getting in touch with you on social media. But as we wrap things up, we want to remind you, you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. We want to remind you once again to visit tnstud.com. Every episode of the Studcast, as well as the Super Studcast and the rest of the story, are there. You can also get Tennessee Stud souvenirs, t-shirts, photos, and so much more. tnstud.com. While you're there, we brought it up. Super Studcast number 11 with the highly successful and knowledgeable Cowboy Bill Watts, available now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99. And once again, it goes a little longer than the usual 2-hour Super Studcast. Check that out now. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, I'm looking ahead a little bit, and I think next week we're gonna get a little bit of both in a way. Things are going to be great. Things are going great in my life at this time frame. But then, you know, there's something that happens, and I think we'll probably talk about it in the next episode. I'm going to make an appearance in Madison Square Garden in New York City for Vince Sr. I'm going to continue to become a star in St. Louis. But I'm going to experience for the first time ever in Florida a little bit of a cold shoulder from the territory. And it's bad enough that I really consider getting out of wrestling for good. So we're going to talk about a little bit about that next week.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.